Tomorrow, mostly sunny, high 75 to 80, slight chance of rain in the afternoon. And Thursday, mostly sunny again and a bit cooler with highs near 68. Coming up at about 8:15, we'll have the big weather picture with Tornado Bob. Let us know if you have questions for him. Text in 218-326-1234. Thanks for listening to KAXC and the Tuesday Morning Show.
Good morning. National Guard troops have been patrolling Washington for more than 2 weeks. The president wants them to do more, creating a special unit that he wants to send to other cities. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. A judge says the U.S. is, quote, absolutely forbidden from deporting Kilmar Abrego Garcia for now. I'm Steve Inskeep.
Enemy Martinez, the man illegally deported to El Salvador, says efforts to send him to Uganda are vindictive. Also, the writer Clint Smith remembers his hometown of New Orleans before Katrina and bearing witness as a family that survived. It's Tuesday, August 26th. On this day in 1939, the Cincinnati Reds and Brooklyn Dodgers played a doubleheader, the first major league games shown on television. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook is promising to fight President Trump's effort to remove her from the central bank's governing board. NPR Scott Horsley reports Trump announced that he was firing Cook in a social media post on Monday night.
This is the latest escalation in President Trump's effort to exert more control over the Federal Reserve. It follows allegations by a Trump ally that Cook made false statements on a mortgage application 4 years ago. The attempt to fire Cook comes in the midst of a high-pressure campaign by the president to get the Fed to lower interest rates. By law, the central bank is designed to be insulated from that kind of political meddling. Cook said in a statement Trump has no authority to fire her, and she vowed to continue to serve on the Fed's governing board. Her attorney says the president's, quote, reflex to bully lacks any legal authority, and he promised to take whatever actions are needed to prevent what he called an illegal firing. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker is pushing back against reports that the Pentagon is planning to deploy the National Guard in Chicago. During a press conference on Monday, Pritzker defended the city's efforts to fight crime while turning the spotlight to other parts of the country.
Like every major American city in both blue and red states, we deal with crime in Chicago. Indeed, the violent crime rate is worse in red states and red cities. Here in Chicago, our civilian police force and elected leaders work every day to combat crime and to improve public safety.
President Trump has called Chicago a, quote, killing field and said it should be the next in what he calls his crackdown on crime. Utah will have to redraw its congressional maps ahead of next year's midterms. That's after a judge ruled the legislature violated the state's constitution. Martha Harris with member station KUER reports lawmakers have 30 days to come up with new maps.
In 2018, Utah voters approved a ballot initiative to ban partisan gerrymandering. State lawmakers significantly weakened the law, and voting rights groups sued. Emma Petty Adams was one of the plaintiffs. After the ruling, she said Utahns have the right to reform their government.
This right cannot be discarded by elected officials for their own political convenience.
Utah 3rd District Judge Diana Gibson said because lawmakers violated the Constitution, the maps they created in 2021 cannot be used in any future elections. In those maps, the state's four U.S. House districts were safe Republican seats. For NPR News, I'm Martha Harris in Salt Lake City.
Stocks closed lower across Asia today. On Wall Street, Dow futures are down at this hour. This is NPR News in Washington. A massive wall of dust swept across Phoenix on Monday, plunging the region into near darkness. Tens of thousands of customers lost power. Drivers were forced to pull over on roadways, and flights were grounded at one of the nation's busiest airports. The U.S. has confirmed its first human case of New World screwworm. NPR's Rachel Treisman reports it's a flesh-eating parasite most often found in livestock.
Federal health authorities confirmed the case earlier this month in a person who had returned from El Salvador. The parasite is typically found in South America. The U.S. eradicated New World screwworm in the 1960s using sterilized flies. The Department of Health and Human Services says the risk to public health in the U.S. is low. Experts say the bigger threat is to the U.S. cattle industry, especially as more infestations are reported in Mexico. The USDA paused live cattle shipments across the southern border earlier this year and said earlier this month it will build a new fly sterilization facility in Texas. Rachel Treisman, NPR News.
Tech billionaire Elon Musk has filed a lawsuit against Apple and OpenAI, accusing the companies of teaming up to reduce competition in artificial intelligence. The crux of the lawsuit revolves around Apple's decision to use ChatGPT as an AI-powered answer engine on the iPhone when the built-in technology on its device couldn't satisfy user needs. In a counter-lawsuit, OpenAI has accused Musk of harassment. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Before you deploy, you get cultural training. I remember we had to learn like some Arabic.
This is Beyond Active Duty, caring for those who served. A series exploring the challenges Minnesota's veterans face, as well as the opportunities and services available to them.
My name is Jodine Eels, and I'm a major in the Minnesota National Guard, and I'm the State Public Affairs Deputy for Minnesota. You are going overseas and you don't know what to expect because it was my first deployment back in 2018. I went to Kuwait. I was the operational security manager for the Middle East. And then I was also the information operations deputy. I was gone for almost a year. I was single when I deployed, which was great for me because, you know, you see your friends be upset and sad because they miss their kids and their spouses. And like, I at the time did not have to deal with that. So it's really nice when you're deployed because we're all from Minnesota and we're together. Everyone was great about supporting each other through that.
Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served is produced by AMPERS with support from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, providing our veterans with help. Veterans can find that help online at minnesotaveteran.org.
Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Illinois Democrats are vowing to pull every lever in their arsenal, including court action to respond if President Trump deploys the National Guard of the state's largest city. Guard soldiers have been patrolling Washington, D.C. for a couple of weeks, and President Trump has hinted that Chicago could be the next city in what he says is a crackdown on violent crime. From member station WBEZ, Alex Degman reports.
Under a mostly cloudy sky, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker and a who's who of Illinois business leaders, clergy, and Democratic politicians gathered in a show of force near the Chicago River downtown. Pritzker said he sees Trump's effort for what it is, because violent crime in Chicago is significantly lower, with a 30% decline in homicides over the past year, according to police.
This is about Donald Trump searching for any justification to deploy the military in a blue city, in a blue state, to try and intimidate his political rivals.
Pritzker accused Trump of having diminished mental faculties and warned him against deploying the National Guard, saying Trump never asked local officials if they wanted that type of help.
Mr. President, do not come to Chicago. You are neither wanted here nor needed here.
Governors typically have control of their state's National Guards, and late 19th century law prohibits the use of military for domestic policing. But the president can use the Insurrection Act to federalize a state's guard during times of rebellion. Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul said he's prepared if Trump goes that route.
There's no foreign invasion. There's no rebellion. My office has filed close to 36 lawsuits fighting the unlawful overreach of the Trump administration. And we're not afraid to do it again.
California filed suit over the National Guard's deployment in Los Angeles earlier this year, making some of the same arguments that Illinois leaders are making. It went to trial in June and now awaits a judge's verdict. It's unclear what concrete steps state leaders can take outside court to counter a military deployment on city streets, but U.S. Senator Dick Durbin says there's something concrete that ordinary Chicagoans can do. Protest.
My friends, don't walk away and say this is just another political issue. This is how democracies die, when people don't stand up and speak up for the basic constitutional rights and freedoms which are part of us in this country.
And Chicago's mayor called Trump's threats uncalled for and unsound. For NPR News, I'm Alex Degman in Springfield, Illinois.
The president is aiming to expand the role of the National Guard in policing using the guard that is based in the District of Columbia. And he's also threatening to punish D.C. and other cities around the country if they abolish cash bail, which Washington has done. Let's talk about this with WAMU senior D.C. politics reporter Alex Coma. Alex, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Cashless bail is going to be a new concept to some people. So how's it work and why is the president so focused on it?
Yeah, well, the basic idea is that, if you're accused of a crime, you're being held in jail before trial, you don't have to post a money bond in order to get out. The decision is entirely in the hands of the courts or, the judges to decide, whether you're a risk to community if you be released. And D.C. hasn't had, a cash bail system since 1992. The reform was sort of, made because I think lawmakers recognized that it disproportionately impacted poor Black people stuck waiting in jail until their trial because they couldn't afford to pay.
And the president objects to this. Why? It seems soft on crime?
Yeah, I mean, his claim is that it lets murderers easily walk free, but that's extremely rare. I mean, just 4% of all people here in D.C. were released before trial were accused of violent crimes last year. So, this is something that has not really had negative consequences. That being said, local leaders are still on edge here because Trump has been meddling with the city's affairs a lot recently, including seizing control of the police department, sending in the National Guard and other federal agents.
What more does he want to do now with the National Guard?
Yeah, so he says he wants to train a special unit of the Guard dedicated to public safety in D.C., and he can do that because he does have command of the Guard here. D.C. isn't a state, so there's no governor who'd be in charge of it. Trump also wants to send similar resources to the Guard in other cities to assist in responding to quote-unquote civil unrest. But the Guard is, of course, limited by what it can do to patrol American cities. Troops can respond if they're attacked, but they don't have police powers or even really the training to assist police, so, no one is really sure how this part is going to work.
How much of this can the president replicate in other cities where he would have less direct authority than he might have in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, I think California points the way here. He can claim some sort of emergency pretext as he did in Los Angeles and send in federal troops, but he'll ultimately run into guardrails. You have governors that have standing to sue, such as Gavin Newsom, who did, and then it can play out in the courts. D.C., you don't have the same situation, and I think that shows why he's doing things here. The city lives in perpetual fear that, he's going to team up with Congress to revoke what limited self-governance the government does have here, and that situation is going to remain unchanged, regardless of the president or party in power, unless the city is someday made a state. He has much less influence in other places unless Congress happens to step in.
Senior D.C. politics reporter Alex Coma of our member station WAMU, one of hundreds of NPR stations in communities across this country. Alex, thanks so much.
It was so great to be here.
For more on President Trump's plan to create what he's calling a specialized unit of D.C. National Guard troops dedicated to public safety, Christopher Purdy is on the line with us. He served for 8 years in the Army National Guard. He's now the CEO of the Chamberlain Network, a pro-democracy advocacy group made up of veterans. So, Christopher, past presidents have assembled specialized National Guard units to carry out particular missions, and you were part of one after the 9/11 attacks. How would you say the scope of this unit compares to the one you served in?
Yeah, thanks for having me, A. So there's still much we don't know about this order, how it's going to be implemented. The unit that I served in was about the size of 300 to 400 people. And this was composed of elements from the Air Force and Army National Guard from different states. And this was really designed to be a quick reaction force. So states would volunteer either company or platoon-sized elements, about 100 or so troops for this particular mission. But we don't know how this is going to be implemented, so we don't know if we're looking at an element that size, a smaller element, which means that people could potentially volunteer into this, or a larger battalion-sized element, 700 to 1,000 troops or so. So there's still lots up in the air about this plan. It's not entirely clear if this is one unit that's being discussed in this executive order or multiple. So these are some real questions that we have.
And back then, I mean, is it fair to say that the mission for you and the people around you were to save Americans from terrorism back then? I mean, what does the mission appear to be here?
Yeah, that's right. So in the mid-2000s, I was a combat engineer, and this was right after 9/11, and we were out there training on disaster recovery, search and rescue, medical services, things like that. The scope of this mission is quite dangerous, and what this does is it will bring National Guard troops more into law enforcement role, which your previous guest talked about, the dangers of that. The laws around that are really confusing and complex. So sending troops nestled under a DC National Guard out to communities in Idaho or Illinois or Texas to do law enforcement really kind of flies in the face of the principles that we have in this democracy of civilian control of the military.
If this was you, Christopher, and say you're going to be sent out, I mean, how would you approach this job or this mission?
That's really difficult. I mean, I don't feel like I would be comfortable participating in a mission that has me as a quick reaction force, for example, to police my community members for, First Amendment speech violations, for example. You know, we know that this president does not like protests. And in the wake of the 2020 protests, he, tried to send the National Guard in to really crack down. I would feel really uncomfortable using my presence as a member of the military to participate in that.
So if you would feel uncomfortable, I mean, it's obviously just a guess on our part, but I mean, there would be at least one or two others that are serving now that might also feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, and so we're speaking to members of the National Guard right now who have been deployed and are at risk of being called up. And there is real worry within the Guard that they will be misused against American citizens. And so really trying to determine what are the rules that Guard members are going to be asked to implement. I would say morale within the Guard units that have been activated really plummets when this happens. No one wants to be used as a police force against their own neighbors. If these Guard members did want to become police, they would have gone into law enforcement, but they didn't. They served in the Army National Guard to defend their country against enemies, and being used in this way really violates the principle of which they served.
Based on what you've seen or heard from the president's executive order, is it clear to you how the chain of command would work here, especially if a governor doesn't want their state guard to be used this way?
That's really the key issue for me. So the way that I interpret this executive order is that states would send their troops to be nestled under the DC National Guard, which, as your previous guest mentioned, is controlled by the president. And the way that the laws around military and policing work is federalized troops cannot be used for law enforcement. But since the DC National Guard is technically not federalized, but controlled by the president, that would be a workaround around this issue. And so we think that that's quite dangerous, and we would really urge courts to reject this this theory, because it fundamentally undercuts the Posse Comitatus Act, which ensures the president can't use the military as a domestic police force.
Well, I was going to ask then about maybe broader implications in terms of the president's use of executive power.
I mean, what this does is it retools both the National Guard and some federal agencies into a new type of law enforcement arm. So we haven't discussed the other part of this executive order. On the executive branch side of things, it converts agencies that typically don't do a lot of public policing, like the Park Service, Department of Transportation, even the Department of Housing and Urban Development, into agencies that would have more of a law enforcement role. So this order is quite expansive and quite dangerous.
Christopher Burdy is an Army National Guard veteran who served in Iraq. He's also the CEO of the Chamberlain Network. Christopher, thanks.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It is 6:19. Thank you for listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on People Powered KAXC. Coming up at 6:30, National Native News, and Heidi Holton and John Latimer are your hosts. We'll hear your talkbacks about what you've been seeing in nature at 6:45, and coming up at 7:20, John Latimer's full phenology report. Support for KAXC comes from Grant Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. Mostly sunny today, highs 71 to 76, lows tonight in the low 50s. Mostly sunny tomorrow, highs 75 to 80, slight chance of rain in the afternoon. A bit cooler again on Thursday with highs in the upper 60s to low 70s. Support for KAXC comes from Schroeder Log Home Supply, supplying wood home and cabin owners with specialty sealants, preservatives, and wood finishes. More information at their Grand Rapids store or online at loghelp.com. The Tally Gallery at Bemidji State University hosts a new retrospective exhibit of work by Marley Call. There's an opening reception Thursday, September 4th from 4 to 7 at the gallery, located in Bridgman Hall on the BSU campus. This exhibit looks back at Call's 60-year artistic journey with some never-before-seen works. It's on display through October 30th. More news is next.
PR comes from the station. And from PBS with Clearing the Air, the War on Smog. American Experience explores how LA's noxious smog problem led to the creation of the EPA and the Clean Air Act, tonight at 9, 8 Central on PBS. From Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate, at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Just days before Hurricane Katrina struck his neighborhood in New Orleans, Clint Smith turned 17. His family heeded the warning to evacuate, and when they returned weeks later, photo albums and artwork they'd secured in garbage bags on the second floor was just about all that survived intact. Clint Smith is now a celebrated writer for The Atlantic who often writes about history and memory, and he wrote about his memory of Katrina and the aftermath in the latest issue. Clint Smith, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
So good to be here.
So you grew up in, what's it called, the Gentilly neighborhood of New Orleans?
Indeed, in Gentilly.
What do you remember about it before Katrina?
Oh, it was an incredible place to grow up. It was really diverse. I remember riding bikes with my friends up and down the street. I remember people playing basketball and everybody kind of going from one driveway or one park to the next to search for an open game or a hoop. I remember the shade of these just massive oak trees as they hung over you, even on hot summer days, providing respite from the heat.
So the morning of August 27th, 2005, you write that your father woke up feeling uneasy. Will you talk about that? What was he uneasy about?
Yeah, so people had begun talking about Katrina as the big one. And the thing to understand about New Orleanians is that this is something that we've been told over and over and over again, that the coming hurricane one year was going to be the one that really wiped New Orleans out. For so many times throughout my childhood, these sort of evacuations were excuses to go hang out with my cousins, hang out with my aunts and uncles in Houston, where we usually evacuated. But this one was obviously different. And Ray Nagin, the mayor at the time, issued a mandatory evacuation for New Orleans, which was the first in history. And I think even before that mandatory evacuation notice went out, my dad, he kind of woke up in the middle of the night and he had a feeling. He was like, I think this is going to be different. And I think that we should get out of here.
So you wound up waiting out the storm in Houston this time. You didn't come back for weeks. Would you describe just what you saw on your street when you first got back?
So we were among the first allowed back into New Orleans after the storm. You know, water sat in New Orleans for weeks. 80% of New Orleans was underwater. Our house was included. And so we all were wearing these hazmat suits and gas masks and made our way to our street and these beautiful oak trees that I described. those branches were all on the ground. They were no longer sort of hanging over the street in a way that felt decadent. And oftentimes the trunks themselves had been uprooted and were strewn across the street in ways that looked like a bomb had gone off. And then when we got to our door, it had the orange spray paint on it that sort of signaled that somebody had come to check and see if there was anybody inside. It told you the date. It told you the crew. It told you how many bodies they found. And ours said zero because no bodies had been found inside.
You know, you ended up staying in Houston. You never really went back to New Orleans. And I take it you didn't go back afterwards. I mean, you live in the D.C. area now. Why do you think?
My sister and I were not able to go back and finish the school year. By the time there was an opportunity to go back, we were already a semester into school. And I think we just accepted that we would finish the school year in this place. But my family came back. We bought a new house. And so I never lived in that house. I still call it the new house, even though my parents have now lived in that house for 20 years.
One of the things that the reason I sort of raised that is that there's a loss. I mean, thankfully, no one in your family lost their lives, but you still lost. You didn't get to be, maybe you'd have been the captain of the soccer team, or you didn't get to go to prom. There was a loss of memory, in a way. I mean, all you have is memory, right, of the before and the after. And in that sense, your experience is that of so many other people in New Orleans who lost their homes, their livelihoods, their places of familiarity. Yeah. Do you think you carry that sense of loss with you?
For a long time, I almost denied that there was a loss because I was raised in a home in a faith tradition that always taught me to focus on that which I have and to think about how fortunate I am relative to other people. And so I think in the context of New Orleans, when it was a moment where you bore witness to a sort of unprecedented stress and
devastation
from, you know, I will always remember the images of people on their rooftops. I will always remember the images of the bodies floating in the water. I'll always remember the images of people in the Superdome when the roof came off. I'll always remember the images of people dying outside the convention center, of people being in the Astrodome in Houston, of people having nowhere to go and just, you know, waiting for months and months and months for a FEMA trailer so that they could come back to their home. And so I say all that because I mourn what I lost in my own life, but relative to so many others, I felt like I almost didn't have the right or the space to sit with that loss.
You're a person of words, a person of memory, a person of history. You kind of tie all those things together. You chose to write about this in very personal terms. I mean, you didn't really deal with the big sort of structural themes
right.
in your piece. And I just wonder what that means. Does it mean that Katrina has really receded into history now?
I think there's two things there. One, that there's this sort of New Orleans diaspora that those of us who left after Katrina, who now only go back for holidays or funerals, or we want our kids to feel a connection to this place, even if it's a place that they have never lived themselves, because it is a place that's unlike anywhere else in the world. The second thing is that the experience of Katrina served as the catalyst for a meaningful interrogation of and a sort of clarifying experience in terms of who the American dream was for and who it wasn't for, who had access and opportunity to upward mobility in this country and who didn't. And I think it, in many ways, was one of the first public, large-scale moments that demonstrated the way in which this country has systemically and intergenerationally failed so many people within the Black community.
Clint Smith is a writer for The Atlantic, and he's the author of the New York Times bestseller, How the Word is Passed. Clint Smith, thank you so much for joining us.
It's always a pleasure.
This is NPR News.
New Orleans' Ninth Ward was one of the areas hardest hit by Hurricane Katrina. Two decades later, this neighborhood is still in an uphill battle to recover.
This is not a third world country. This is New Orleans. No, we're only 10 minutes from the French Quarters, and the people that's here in the lower Ninth Ward, they're still suffering.
I'm Elsa Chang, the ongoing fight to save the Ninth Ward on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock with your local host, Jennifer Barr. It is almost 6:30. I'm Heidi Holton with John Latimer, and it's the Tuesday morning show. Hope you're having a good morning.
Good morning, Heidi. How are you doing?
I'm good.
You're just back from a voyage. Well, an excursion.
Right.
I guess a voyage implies boats, and you could see boats from where you were, but...
Yes. I was on a Ferris wheel where I saw some boats.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I was in San Francisco with a cousin who knew someone. We could stay in their condo, and I did not realize what great views we would have looking at Fisherman's Wharf and Alcatraz and the Golden Gate Bridge every morning on the deck. It was crazy. Really fun and relaxing.
Nice view.
Yeah. So fun.
Yeah.
But also so glad to be back. It's like one of those nice things when you go off somewhere where it doesn't make sense to have a car, and that's kind of liberating.
Yeah.
You know, and then you're also like, man, I can't wait to get back to, you know, drive north and be outside. Went out last night, checking the garden, picking cucumbers, looking at bugs, picking apples. That felt really good.
Looking at bugs?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
I don't know.
You find any?
Yes. Really odd.
Mosquitoes? Deer?
Well.
Too late for the deer flies,
right.
Probably.
They were these, let's just put it this way. They'd be really cute earrings.
Ah.
They were these small little metallic bugs, you know, on top of each other on these leaves. And there's lots of them.
So there are going to be more of them.
Yes, they will be.
All right. Well, that's good news.
Didn't really realize that when I got in close to stare at them.
I'm inordinately fond of bugs, and especially if they're the kind of bugs like you saw that are just gorgeous, but they don't show up and aggravate like deer flies.
Right.
I mean, if you actually look at deer flies, they're quite beautiful. Some have red eyes, some have green eyes. The stripes on their bodies can be really remarkable, but
they're jerks.
They come looking for a meal, you know? And that kind of puts them on the other side of the equation for me. It's like, I don't care how pretty you are. I am going to kill you if I get the chance.
Yeah.
My expression, and you probably have heard me say it, and for deer flies and for mosquitoes, it's the same. It's come for the sandwiches, stay for the funeral.
Oh, my gosh. You had some fun. You were talking about boats. You had some fun on boats while I was gone.
Went out sailing on Saturday. John and I took the boat out and had quite an adventure. Ended up tipping over and sinking the boat. Not sinking, filling the boat with water. The boat will float even full of water, but it won't sail very well. So we had some assistance from some kind folks who were, oddly enough, visiting the area from the cities. And they were nearby with a pontoon boat, and they came over to ask if we needed some help, and we did. So they towed us into shore, and then we got a help from the folks who lived there. And lucky for us, their family had their strapping son and two of his good buddies came down, and the five of us bailed the boat out, and we were back sailing before we knew it. So all the adventures that a guy could want. Saturday was kind of a cool day up here. It was in the 60s. But the water temperature was, you know, what it is, 75 maybe. It was delightful to be in the lake. It was soaking wet and out of the lake on the sailboat when we both started to get pretty cold.
Wow.
Adventures.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
We should do it
life,
when we can,
life
right?
has got to be an adventure.
Today we're looking at temperatures 72 to 76 with calm west winds. And partly cloudy tonight, becoming clear, lows 52 to 58. And then we do have a slight chance of rain and thunderstorms moving in tomorrow morning and into the afternoon. Highs in the mid-70s to low 80s overnight, upper 40s to low 50s, and then 68 to 73 on Thursday. But looking like we're going to be seeing some chillier.
Yeah, well, we're almost done with August, moving into September. So we'll preview September next week, so you know what to expect. But the rain would be welcome. I checked my rain totals for the month of August so far. As of this morning, I've had 0.5 inch, 0.050 inches of rain for the whole month, which is roughly 3.5 inches below what it should be. It might be a little less than 3.5, but you're normally June, July, and August, the totals run close to 4 inches. So we're back into drought again. It's not severe. My grass is still growing, so. But.
Yeah, I saw some browning of things and. But, yeah, looking.
Yeah, we definitely could use some more rain, especially going into fall. Like to carry a little moisture through the winter. It helps everybody in the spring. We receive support from North Holmes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northholmes.org.
Coming up, we'll have National Native News. It's produced by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Then we'll bring you student finale.
They're
students.
We're
all students, you know, really.
Really, if you're out in nature, you should be curious enough to learn something, which makes you a student. So yeah, I had a nice visit with some children. I get to do this program out at Sugar Lake Lodge, where I walk the kids around, and kids and adults. And, gosh, we just had a nice group. And unfortunately, it rained. Not hard. It was one of those little squalls that came through, just sort of broke up the party. But there were almost 40 people in this group. We were definitely heading into fun times. The dragonflies are decreasing in numbers. The frogs are decreasing in numbers. I think all of the frogs in that little pond have been caught at least once and examined and held by children. And yeah, so it's always a nice time. But yeah, we've got some voices from that group, and we've got a group from Long Lake Conservation Center. And, of course, don't forget to check your Instagram. If you're on Instagram, check out the Little Falls Phenology page on Instagram. They, Chad Kaditz is a really amazing teacher, and they have a wonderful program there where they invite the students, last year's students, and any previous student. They get observations from all over the place, and the kids send in pictures that are just wonderful. Get them all identified and put them up there, and you can check those pictures out and see what the kids are seeing. It'll only be another week or so, and we're going to be getting some reports in from students again, and that's a pretty exciting time.
I know. It tickles me to hear you say, check your Instagram.
Well, yeah, check your Instagram.
Right.
I have an account at Facebook, and... if I have any other accounts, I don't know about them.
I think you at one point, it's not called Twitter anymore, but I think you had Twitter, but you didn't use it.
Yeah,
if I remember right.
Right, yep.
And who knows, maybe your son set up your Instagram too.
They've threatened, and my wife is always showing me things that are happening on Instagram family-wise and other places. And, it looks like a pretty interesting spot, but I'd have to get another password. And
yes, I hear you.
Just, you know, I don't suffer that whole password thing. Like I log in someplace and they ask for a password and I'm like, screw it, I'm going outside. I don't need the aggravation. I don't know the password. Okay. Why would I?
Good way to live your life. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, there are a few of us Luddites left.
Up next, we are learning about how a number of street signs in Northern Ireland that have the island's indigenous language have been damaged throughout the summer, and now the police are investigating this. these incidences as hate crimes. Stay tuned for that story. Then we'll bring you a little preview of Grand Rapids River Fest. It's right around the corner coming up September 6th.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A number of street signs in Northern Ireland, which include the island's indigenous language, have been damaged throughout the summer. And now, police are investigating the incidents as hate crimes, as Sean McPullen reports.
Several dual-language street signs in the Irish county of Tyrone were recently damaged or defaced with paint. Police investigators believe the destruction may have been motivated by prejudice and could arrest the perpetrators under Northern Ireland's unique hate crime laws. The Irish language is also under attack in the country's courts. Plans to install signs with the indigenous language at Belfast's new Grand Central Station may be canceled. Next month, a judge will hear a lawsuit by a far-right activist to stop the new signs. Both issues will soon be addressed by the country's first Irish language commissioner, who is expected to be confirmed in the coming weeks. This new role is thought to be a litmus test for the British government, which historically discriminated against the language. For National Native News, I'm Sean McPullen in Ireland.
For decades, Albuquerque locals have been going to the Indian Pueblo Kitchen for indigenous cuisine. Starting this week, visitors can get a taste of the Southwest without even leaving the airport. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more.
First opening its doors in 1976, the restaurant was reimagined in 2020.
Every Pueblo has a different style of what they cook, what they make.
Chef Josh Aragon is from the Laguna Pueblo and heads the kitchen at the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center on tribal land in the heart of Albuquerque.
It's just a combination of all the Pueblos put together, all 19, as a matter of fact. And what comes out of the food is the smiles, the thoughts, the full bellies.
From fry bread and enchiladas to daily hand-baked goods, like Pueblo pies, tortillas, and lots of loaves of bread.
Yesterday I did 3 batches, so about 104 plus 240 dough balls.
Rita Toledo is the head baker. She's from the Jemez Pueblo and now has to prepare even more fresh dishes to feed hungry customers at Albuquerque International Sunport.
The bread we bake, somebody's going to take somewhere out of state. That's exciting.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Western Michigan University is launching a Native American Elders in Residence program. The new program is intended to bridge the generational gap between students and indigenous leaders at the university. The university received an award from the Native American Heritage Fund to launch the program called Sharing Wisdom Across Generations. Western's Native American Affairs Council is consulting with elders and tribal councils of the 3 Potawatomi Nations in Southwest Michigan. Dr. Dee Sherwood, director of the Native American Affairs Council, says elders have vast knowledge. They may have attended a boarding school, lived on the reservation their whole life, or maybe have experience as a veteran or an entrepreneur, and that the program offers the opportunity to learn from older generations for both Native and non-Native students. 3 elders will hold regular office hours. They'll also participate in 10 events over the next year, which could range from drum workshops, beadwork and ribbon skirt making, or talking circles. Next month, the university will be recognized alongside 10 other educational and community organizations selected for grants by the Native American Heritage Fund. The clothing brand For Kinship is hosting a youth event next week at the Navajo Nation Fair in Window Rock, Arizona, called Good Medicine Youth Day. During the event, 2,000 skateboards and wellness items will be distributed to families. The brand helped build a skate park in a Navajo community with skateboarder Tony Hawk and has given away thousands of skateboards across the Navajo Nation. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation with funding in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and the Ford Foundation and the Annenberg Foundation. Shuttered their doors, of course, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, as all funding was rescinded. That means over 1,500 stations across the nation lost that funding that was already promised and budgeted for. And we can't thank you enough for helping us through this. We've heard from so many of you that have helped us raise money to deal with the 13% loss of our budget as we go forward. That'll be yearly, And we're working hard behind the scenes to make sure we can find different ways to support KEXE, because we are determined we are going to stick around.
Yeah, absolutely. We will be here. Count on us. Mm-hmm. They're not getting rid of me.
Nope. And we're confident because of you, because people who listen, people who step forward, people who came out to our community events, those who send us phenology reports, we understand that this sort of connection makes a difference. And we thank you. We're glad to be here. I'm Heidi Holton. That's John Latimer. Thanks for being with us this morning. We've got a great day ahead of nature and weather and kids programs from Happy Dancing Turtle, a bright spot coming up before 9 o'clock when DJ Dang will be our host for Headwaters.
Support for KAXE comes from the Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation, playing a vital role in connecting charitable intentions with community needs. Awarding $30 million in grants and scholarships over the past 30 years to make a lasting impact in our area. More information at gracf.org.
Applications are now open for the University of Minnesota Extension Master Gardener Volunteer Program. You can learn how to share science-based horticulture knowledge with people in your area. The course begins in January. Deadline to apply is October 1st. You can learn more. You can visit z.umn.edu or contact your local extension office. Grand Rapids River Fest coming up on September 6th. We're so excited. We've got headliner Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. This is one of my favorite Margot Price songs, and I just need to hear it again this morning. It's inspiring. It's called Bend to the Mountain. Tickets are still available for this. The cost will go up on the day of the event, and it is a community event that KEXE, a nonprofit community radio station, puts on. If you've already supported us through this crisis, this is another way to do it. Get a ticket for a friend. Buy your tickets, even if you haven't fully decided if you can make it. That helps us out and keeps us planning community events like this. Here's Margot Price. Get your tickets now at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com.
every name in the book, honey. Go on, take your best shot. Take your best shot. Take your best shot. Yeah, I got my best turn, got me aiming my heart. Go on, take your best shot now. I am the hunter and I am the haunted. I am a baby, I'm wanted. I'm an alchemist teacher, I'm a sinner, I'm a preacher.
There she is. It's Margo Price. I've been to the mountain. She is in concert on Saturday, September 6th for Grand Rapids River Fest. This year's lineup is Courtney Barnett, Margo Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. You can get your tickets and information at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. If you want to help us out by volunteering at the event, there are a few spots left. Look for Get Involved at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com.
Yeah, come and join us. I'll be there for sure. Yeah. You may count on that. Well, good music and good times. Opportunity to run into a lot of other supporters of KEXE. Mm-hmm. And hear some good music, eat some good food, drink a few beers. It's right. Just a nice afternoon, evening kind of a gig.
All local vendors and food trucks and... It's a way to support the local community, not just KEXE. It's going to be a great time, September 6th. Hope to see you there. You can find out lots more information. Look for photos, and you get a feel for what the day is like at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com.
We receive support from Oak Hill Assisted Living in Grand Rapids, providing personalized care in a home setting. More information at OakHillSeniors.com. It's time for what we have called student phenology over the summer. It becomes an opportunity for each and every one of you to share some observations that you might have had. Today, we are going to be hearing from future teachers at Long Lake Conservation Center. We're going to be hearing from a couple of young boys that were at the Sugar Lake Lodge. Langdon, let me see, I'm sorry. Make sure I get the names right here. Blake and Logan are going to be announcing their findings. Chad Caddett's class has got some photographs for you to look at. And we heard from Don Leon in Stearns County with an account of a really unusual bumblebee, at least unusual for me. So... Funding for student phenology is provided in part by the Minnesota Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. Phenology talkbacks are produced by Charlie Mitchell. Our next report, our first report, comes from Isaac and other future teachers at Long Lake Conservation Center near Palisade.
Hello, this is Isaac, future elementary teacher from the Minnesota North Itasca Class Act Pre-Education Group, reporting from Long Lake Conservation Center from August 21st to the 22nd. The high temperature was 81 degrees Fahrenheit with 60% humidity and a south wind at 11 miles per hour. Here are some of the nature notes from our trip. We saw leopard frogs, beavers near their lodge in the lake, chicken of the woods, chanterelle mushrooms, coral tooth fungus, and another mushroom that smelled like pine. There are signs of autumn all around, including a few maples showing the earliest signs of turning color. We suspect that these are sick or stressed trees because this is too early. The first of the sarsaparilla leaves are turning yellow. Aster and goldenrod are in bloom. We spotted a handful of bumblebees, mostly on the bee balm. Long Lake staff says that the population of bumblebees is way down compared to previous years. A July bee survey found zero. A few groups of waterfowl have been spotted by the lake, including mergansers, buffleheads, and a great blue heron. They aren't staying for long, so they are only making a short pit stop on the long journey south. It was a great visit with nature, and we want to remind you to unplug, get outside, and live connected.
Thank you, Isaac. Nice report from that area. Lots of things there that you probably could see if you got out in the woods around your house, including leopard frogs, maybe a beaver or two. Chicken of the woods is a wonderful mushroom. Chanterelles, also a wonderful mushroom. Both of those are delicious. Coral tooth fungus, edible, but I've never had it, so I can't tell you what it's like. Maples, earliest signs of turning color. You know, they might be sick. They might be stressed. They might just be, you know, way over there on the leading edge of that bell curve that is fall when it comes to tree color. We'll have to wait and see. Sarsaparilla leaves are turning yellow. So are the leaves of the spraying dogbane, and few leaves on the milkweed as well. Aster and goldenrods are definitely in bloom. Bumblebees, I've been seeing a few bumblebees, and we had quite a few all summer long. I thought the population of bumblebees looked pretty good after a kind of a slow start. Mergansers, buffleheads, and great blue herons along the lake. Yeah, that's always fun. Good time of year to watch the water and see who's moving through. Our next report comes from Sugar Lake Lodge near Grand Rapids.
Hello, this is John Latimer, and these are the voices of some of the children that went along on our nature hike at Sugar Lake Lodge today.
My name is Blake, and I saw a frog. It was a green frog. I saw exploding seeds, and one just popped on my head, so yeah.
My name is Logan Mastriano, and I saw one golf ball, and I saw two green frogs and one leopard frog. I got to smell two different types of pine trees. One was the balsam, and it smelled like Christmas. The other one was the spruce, and it smelled kind of like lemons.
Thank you, Logan. Thank you, Blake. What Blake was saying, and you may not have understood it, but he was talking about exploding seeds, and we were examining the seed pods of the spotted touch-me-not, and they are very ripe right now, and the kids were all trying to find one and get it off the plant to explode it around their friends, and they were popping and exploding just whenever you got near them, it seemed. But Blake managed to have one pop near his head. Next, take a look at what Chad Caddett's students at the Little Falls Middle School are seeing this summer. You can see their pictures on Instagram at Little Falls Phenology. That's little sub, what do they call that? Subtext?
Subscript.
Subscript. The little line that's underneath. Little Subscript Falls Subscript Phenology. And there are some wonderful pictures associated with those notes, including a beautiful white caterpillar, grasshopper, red-legged grasshopper, first of the season common nighthawk, and Nashville warbler, which is kind of hiding in the background of one of the pictures. The nighthawks, I missed the migration this year. I did not see migration of the nighthawks. So I would say if you have, maybe you should report it, because this is the time of year, usually sometime in the week of the 20th, the nighthawks pile through on their way south. Our final report today is from Don Leon in Stearns County. And Don had this to say: squash longhorn cuckoo bees can easily be mistaken for wasps due to their lack of pollen collecting hairs and their wasp-like body structure. Cuckoo bees are kleptoparasites. They do not build their own nests or harvest provisions for their offspring. Instead, like cuckoo birds, they lay their eggs in the nests of other species. Female squash longhorn cuckoo bees lay their eggs in the ground nests of squash bees that specialize in foraging on pumpkins in the genus Cucurbita, to include squash, pumpkin, and gourd. When the eggs hatch, the larvae will kill the squash bee larvae and consume the pollen and nectar.